Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The meat industry is global, but pretty much only in the United States do we expect to have access to meat pretty much whenever, however, and wherever we want it. Coming up, we'll hear from a historian who has written about the history of meat in the United States and how our history differs from others and how our demand drives the industry. But first, that industry faces big changes with new federal labeling rules that require meat packers to list where livestock was born, raised, and slaughtered. Joining us now to talk about that is David Pearson. He's a business writer for the LA Times covering food and agriculture. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Happy to be here.
David, the old law, the country of origin labeling law, required companies to list all countries involved in where livestock was born, raised, and slaughtered, but it didn't require so many details. What exactly has changed?
Yeah, this is an enhancement of an existing rule. So if you go to the grocery store today and you go to the meat case and you pick up a steak, pay attention to the label. Somewhere on the barcode and the price tag, you'll see in fine print where the meat was born, where it was raised, and where it was slaughtered, though they'll use the euphemism harvested instead. And the idea is to give consumers a more informed decision about where their meat comes from. It's a food safety issue, but it's also roiling the industry because a lot of the importers feel like they're being unfairly treated and singled out.
So who wanted the change and why did they want it?
Well, a lot of consumer groups wanted the change, but the USDA is really behind this. This actually has its origins back in 2002. It's amazing to think it's taken a decade for this to roll out. But in 2002, everyone was very concerned about mad cow disease in England. So in the Farm Bill, they asked for more enhanced labeling, country of origin labeling, but it wasn't implemented until 2008. And that's when we had the first level of country of origin, which was just, you know, what countries were involved, but we didn't know what was taking place in those countries. The Canadian and Mexican governments took issue with that because a lot of our imported meat comes from those two neighboring countries. And so they went to the WTO. The USDA decided that they had to change the rule to make it less discriminatory towards Mexico and Canada, and they ended up with this, which still angers the Mexicans and the Canadians, and we could see more WTO action.
Some U.S. beef ranchers support the more stringent labeling, some don't. What's the difference between them?
Well, I think most U.S. ranchers do support this because it would essentially... It would make it a lot easier to buy and pack and sell U.S. meat. The meat packers are going to have to pay extra, essentially, now to create a new processing line for imported meat, which means it just makes sense for them to turn to U.S. meat. And then secondly, I think U.S. consumers, when they read the labeling, they're going to want to buy U.S. meat more than foreign meat. Once they see this, I think it's going to be a lot harder for Mexican and Canadian beef ranchers to compete.
Now, major meat packers, as you mentioned, such as Cargill, Inc., and others oppose the law as wasteful and costly. How much will it cost? Who's likely to pay the tab?
Well, it's the USDA estimates that the cost is going to be somewhere from $50 million to close to about $192 million in additional costs. And that's going to come from separating the meat from different countries in their processing plants. This is what they called before commingling. So commingling of different herds from different countries is going to be prohibited. And then there is going to be the cost for retailers, for the grocery stores that have to create new labeling. And the one exemption is ground beef. Ground beef is a very complicated product. It takes meat, different cuts of meat from all over the world to create that sort of lean, fatty balance, and they aren't required to stop commingling. And their labeling also is unable to go into that same detail of born, harvested, and slaughtered.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with David Pearson. He's a business writer for the LA Times, where he covers food and agriculture. We're talking about the new meat labeling laws in the United States. If you have a question or comment for David, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. He'll only be on for the segment, though, so don't wait. Give us your call or send your email right away. The American Meat Institute and others, including the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and National Pork Producers Council, filed a lawsuit against the USDA this summer about this issue. And first of all, before we talk about the status of the lawsuit, what's the difference between the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and, say, U.S. beef ranchers? Aren't they on the same plate? I was going to say the same plate. Are they on the same side?
Yeah, no, the cattlemen's represent more the interests of the meat packing industry, and then the other one is, of course, with the ranchers. We're hoping to see a boost in U.S. sales.
Okay, and what is the status of that lawsuit? First of all, what does the lawsuit claim?
So it's sort of the opposite of free speech. They're saying they're compelled speech. So they're worried that they have to provide more information than is necessary by law. And the lawsuit was filed in July, but a federal judge in September denied a preliminary injunction to block these rules that actually rolled out just a couple of weekends ago. And so they're appealing that now.
And what are the expectations of this lawsuit? I mean, can they turn back the hands of time?
Well, I think the meatpacking industry is hoping that the farm bill, the still unsigned farm bill, will save them and will reverse this law. The farm bill has some language in it that would explore more economic analysis of country of origin labeling. And the hope is, if they lobby hard enough, that this law will be repealed once the farm bill is signed. But it's not looking like that's going to happen this year. We're probably going to have to wait until a few months until next year before that happens.
How much more economic analysis can they do? They started looking at this change of law in 2002, you said, and in 2008 they finally passed the law. What more can they analyze?
There's a lot of back and forth. It's really incredible. But I mean, what you're seeing here really is, an industry that's been set in its ways for a long time, and something coming in and asking them to change processes that, was really efficient for the meat industry. They're able to pull herds from all over the world according to, spot prices at the time. It's something they're having a really hard time accepting.
You mentioned that grocery stores will be doing the labeling. I'm confused about that. Why would the grocery stores be responsible for labeling? I guess it's whatever they package at the butchers.
So they have their own labeling.
And is it likely that the costs, this $63 or $60 million to $192 million dollar cost to do this, will be passed on to the consumers, or does the industry expect to absorb it?
There's a chance it could be passed on to consumers, but what I'm told is that it's mainly going to be absorbed by the meat packers. And another cost that we have to think about too is Mexico and Canada are preparing tariffs, and right now there's a WTO committee that's been formed to basically
world
decide whether
at the World Trade Organization.
At the World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. Excuse me. Yeah, to constitute whether this is unfair trade. And both our neighboring countries are preparing tariffs, and I think they're ready to use that if they have to.
Hmm. In some ways, I'm surprised Canada isn't in front of the United States on this. This United States isn't the only country that has these kinds of labeling laws, though, right?
I'm not aware of that. I'm only aware of the United States going this far.
Okay. You mentioned that it will eliminate almost all commingling. You said that's combining herds from different countries, and that creates an inefficiency. How much meat do we eat that's from the United States now?
So the majority of of meat. I mean, the overwhelming majority of meat is from the United States, but it's still, you know, imports are still a sizable amount. I mean, you know, with beef, we're talking about you know, close to 30 billion pounds last year. That's just under 8% of all imports. Pork is, you know, 3.3%. Pork imports, that is 3.3% of all the pork we eat. And lamb, I mean, half the lamb we eat in this country is from overseas. And but chicken, not so much. Chicken is harvested almost exclusively in the United States. But meat imports are you know, a pretty significant amount of our supply. And, you know, America also exports a lot of meat, too. This is a big globalized industry, and a lot of the cheap cuts, the tougher cuts that we don't like here in America, go overseas. You know, we like to keep our middle meats, our tender steaks.
So commingling is still permitted in the production of ground beef. So does that mean that the pink slime remains legal, that kind of commingling is still okay?
No, I mean, commingling is okay in the ground beef industry, because, you know, there's efficiencies in finding lean beef and fatty beef, and you have to pull all these different sources together to get what we usually see in the grocery store, that 80% to 20% or that 90% to 10% that consumers like. Pink slime is still not acceptable. But I think that's sort of a different issue.
Okay. All right. Well, Dave Pearson, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
David Pearson, he's a business writer for the LA Times. He covers food and agriculture. Coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher, we'll talk to a historian about America's meat culture and how the consumption of meat has shaped our history. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Meat, it's as American as apple pie. And its imprint in the culture was made way back when European settlers first set foot in North America, turning it into what author and historian Maureen Ogle calls a meat eater's paradise. Maureen Ogle has written a new book about the history of meat in America. It's called In Meat We Trust: An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. She joins us today by phone from Ames, Iowa. Welcome to the show, Maureen.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
The subtitle refers to an unexpected history of carnivore America. What's unexpected about it?
Well, first of all, let me say I didn't write the title, so I'm now assuming that I'm inside the minds of the marketers.
What were they thinking, Maureen?
Well, they were thinking, can we sell this book? I think what they were getting at, and rightfully so, was that I suspect that many Americans have this notion of what meat is and what it all means, and the general tale that people kept telling me when they found out I was writing this book was that somehow big corporations have taken over the meat supply, and they run a monopoly, and they make dangerous meat, and they're trying to control what we eat. And what I found was pretty much the opposite of all that. So for me, it did turn out to be, frankly, an unexpected history, yes.
So what is the larger definition of the American way of meat that you write about?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I coined that phrase. I never thought about it. Okay, what do I mean by the American way of meat?
It's not a trick question, Maureen.
I know. I think what I mean by that is that the way we Americans, I think, have a real sense of entitlement when it comes to the place of meat in our diets. We assume and expect that we will have meat whenever we want it. Obviously, many people don't eat much meat. Some people don't eat any meat. But for people who do eat meat, the expectation is that it's always going to be there, and it's always going to be affordable. And behind that, satisfying that sense of entitlement is are the livestock industries and the meatpacking industries, and those are both servants to consumer demand rather than the other way around. That's what I mean by the American way of meat.
Often we're seen as being victimized or kind of mildly, I victimize not in a violent way, but in a passively we're passively victimized by it. We're you know, victimized by the culture. There's McDonald's on every street corner. We can't help it but eat meat. That's what they serve us.
I don't buy that. I just, the argument, sort of big argument, critique, let's not call it an argument.
Okay.
Big critique of meat in America right now, the you know, how we get our meat and how much we eat of it is that indeed we're almost literally having it crammed down our throats by big corporations like McDonald's or like Tyson or, you know, name some big company that manufactures meat-based products. I just flat out don't buy that. It seems to me that when we blame corporations for things, all we do is reduce ourselves to witless dupes. We do, in fact, become victims. I'm not buying it. I don't know about anybody else, but the only person who controls what comes into my kitchen and what I eat is me, and I just flat out don't buy that argument. I'm not a witless dupe. I make rational decisions.
What distinguishes this American way from other westernized industrialized countries? Do they have a similar relationship with meat?
That is a very good question. I think you were right to kind of separate Western industrialized from the rest of the world.
Right.
We can talk about that more. Here's an interesting fact. Historically, the rest of the Western world, and let's just decide that is let's include South America, but primarily let's think about Europe and England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Historically, those cultures have also had have embraced meat and have a fairly meat-centric diet. But those countries are also located in a place where there's a limited landmass. And for the last 150 years or so, those countries have not been able to supply their own meat, and they rely heavily and have relied heavily, indeed, since the colonial period, have relied heavily on meats that were packaged and processed and exported out of first the American colonies and then the United States. And in European countries today, the meat industries that exist tend to be, what's the word I want to use? They tend to be much smaller scale and not quite as factory-like. But the reason that they can adopt those kinds of regulations is because when push comes to shove and they actually need meat, they just get it from the United States. Interestingly, for anybody who hates the idea of confined feeding operations, concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, also known as factory livestock farms, Americans actually borrowed that idea from Northern Europeans in the 1950s who were using concentrated feeding operations as a way to try to raise livestock with very, very limited amounts of land. What a CAFO does is save both land and labor. So on the one hand, in the other Western industrial nations are happy to rely on us on meat, but the reason they do that is because they have the luxury to impose regulations on themselves that make it not possible for them to produce enough meat for themselves.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Maureen Ogle. She's a historian and the author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Where did the have-it-all and have-it-all our way come from?
Well, I was surprised. I should say, again, you've been very careful to explain that I'm a historian. I'm not a journalist. So
right.
My intention here was, frankly, to write a history of something I knew absolutely nothing about. And I was actually astonished to discover how much of the politics of colonial America was driven in part by settlers' demand for land. Almost from the first minute people got off those boats and waded ashore, they discovered what they did not have back in the old world, which was, as near as they could tell, an infinite amount of land. It certainly seemed infinite to them. And for the first time, people who came from a world of scarcity found a place where, man, anybody could raise livestock and enjoy a meat-centric diet. And even long before the American Revolution, visitors who came over to check out these settlers who were busily settling, colonizing the eastern seaboard of North America were astounded by how much meat the people here ate. By the time the Revolution came, even the poorest Americans, and I'm excluding slaves here because that was always a special case of diet and nutrition, mm-hmm. but everyone just assumed and expected that they would have a meat-centric diet. When immigrants in the 19th century would write letters home, they often lied about how much meat they ate because they simply knew people back home wouldn't believe them. So our sense of entitlement, I discovered to my surprise, is, you know, almost bred into us from the colonial period. It was fascinating.
We are now in the middle of the holidays, I suppose, having just finished that Thanksgiving turkey and Thanksgivica, and perhaps planning another for Christmas or New Year's. You recently wrote an article saying to anti-meat eaters that if they don't like it, they can blame the first Thanksgiving meal.
Right, right. That was a commissioned piece, and the outlet that commissioned it, which was Time Magazine, asked me to specifically relate what I just explained about colonists to what is wrongly described as the first Thanksgiving meal in 1621, a year after the people who later became pilgrims came ashore on Massachusetts. They had a very bad first year. More than half of them died. There was not enough food. They had no idea what they were doing. It was a wilderness, after all, and the Native Americans, whom the whites referred to as savages, helped them survive. And when their meager harvest was in November, they decided to have just basically take a break and have a feast. And what they ate at that feast was, for meat, was venison. They still had no livestock. They had not brought any domesticated livestock with them. And they had already figured out that the Native Americans also had no domesticated livestock. And in the mindset of a European, those Native Americans were therefore not entitled to the land. They did not practice livestock husbandry. They did not build farms and fences. They did not keep domesticated livestock. And the clear mark of distinction between a savage and a civilized person in the minds of white people was that white people practiced livestock husbandry. And there was no way anybody was going to let them, you know, suffer through another meal of having to rely on eating game. Poaching and hunting, by the way, were regarded as sort of opposite sides of the same coin by these same Europeans. Mm. The only people who were allowed to hunt were very wealthy elites, the very kinds of people that these particular settlers had left England to get away from. And poaching was what anybody who wasn't a higher-class person did when they went hunting. And by cracky, these people were not going to be poachers. They were not going to rely on wild game. And that mindset is what drove a great deal of this conflict. So, you know, I was sort of tongue-in-cheek that blamed that first Thanksgiving meal, which really wasn't a meal of Thanksgiving. It was just simply a harvest feast, the kind of feast that humans had celebrated for millennia.
It's interesting about that mindset about hunting. Of course, deer season just started here in Ohio.
Yeah.
Go deer hunters, I guess. But by implementing the European animal husbandry practices, they did create a lot of conflict with Native Americans and pretty much wrecked it for them.
That's right. Because white people wanted livestock, they also wanted land on which to graze that livestock, particularly cattle. And I was astonished to discover that over and over again, Native American conflicts were often started. You know, I think our image of what happened in colonial America is that somehow these white people just show up and drove natives off the land. But it was clear from the research and reading I did that the reason they were driving them off the land was they wanted that land for livestock. And if the Native Americans were not going to fence it and raise livestock and graze cattle and keep hogs, then they weren't entitled to the land. And of course, the more Native Americans got pushed off their land, they were being pushed onto other Native American land. So you had multiple kinds of warfare and conflict that dragged on for most of the 1600s. I was really, really surprised. And much of the treaties and legislation aimed at resolving those conflicts were always geared toward what white people could do, the freedom they were given to raise their livestock.
The emphasis on meat in the diet, particularly compared to the folks back home who didn't have as much access to it, did the difference in the diets start to show themselves in the stature of the people pretty early on or not?
Yes, there are a group of historians, I'm not one of them, that's not my specialty, who actually track things like that, stature rates and what is believed to be nutrition. It is extremely difficult to track people's actual diets. Believe it or not, archaeology has to play a big role in this so that you can count things like how many bones are left in a midden pit. But yes, Americans were eating well. There's no doubt about that. They were eating a lot of meat. And I should also make this point about the meat-centric ways of our early American ancestors. Keeping livestock was a lot easier than raising crops and then trying to put that food by, keeping those crops secure through the winter. It required a lot of labor. And remember, there's no refrigeration. There's not much of anything. So trying to process foods and save them through winter months after harvest was very difficult. But it was, by comparison, much easier to keep livestock and to slaughter an animal and, you know, dry the beef or smoke the hog carcass or whatever. So by default, meat was not just abundant. It was also less labor-intensive than was trying to, say, make sure you have a supply of, I don't know, potatoes through the winter or, you know, trying to keep fresh vegetables. Very difficult to do.
How soon did the dependence on American-raised livestock occur in Europe and other places in the world?
Right off the bat. As soon as it became clear that there was livestock here, I found evidence of a hefty, busy export market in both barreled beef, and beef doesn't keep nearly as well as being smoked or dried or pickled as pork does. There was a thriving market already by the 1650s. It's not an exaggeration to say that Americans who raised livestock and those who then slaughtered and processed it were already engaging in a global market long before the American Revolution, long before it.
And just culturally, the reason why this didn't extend beyond Europe, all things being equal, was for cultural or religious reasons or what?
Well, in the 17th century, Westerners had still not quite created empires on which the sun did not yet set. But what they did do, Americans were supplying barreled meats. Again, this is not fresh meat. This is preserved meat, both beef and pork. They were supplying that to ship's captains. So it was, in effect, being taken all over the world. It was feeding sailors in these long global voyages, and it was also being used as trade. So there were American meats ending up in amazingly far-flung places, including Asia.
And given the standards of the day for meat packing and meat preservation, did this create some problems, illnesses around the world as well?
As near as I can tell, no.
Interesting.
If you, one of the big markets that emerged just before and then certainly right after the American Revolution was supplying factory workers, particularly in England. I'm going to take a wild guess. Most of your listeners have heard of the Industrial Revolution, and that in part involved people moving from farms into urban areas and working in factories. And a lot of the meat that Americans were packing was being sent to feed factory workers, not just in England, all over Europe. And those meats were generally regarded as the worst of the bunch. You know, this was cheap. I think I'm pretty safe in saying that if you and I were presented with a plate of it, we'd go, "Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to eat that." I think by our standards, it would be regarded as poor meat, but there was no reason to fear it. It was all preserved. It was packed in brine.
My guest is Maureen Ogle. She's a historian and the author of a new book about meat. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. If you have a question or comment for Maureen, you're welcome to give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Maureen Ogle, historian and author. We're talking about her newest book. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Maureen, you work on some myth-busting in the book, including the idea that industrial agriculture is a result of the post-war corporate takeover of the family farm. You talked a little bit about that already. Where did the myth come from?
How much time have we got, and do we want to get into that? I'm gonna.
Let's shoot for about a minute.
Okay, I'm gonna just strip this down to an essence. I almost hate to use the word Marx, but I'm gonna go ahead and use it anyway. There is, in fact, a Marxian argument about how our economy runs, and when you strip all that down, what you get with is capital has its own autonomy, and corporations do whatever they want, and they run roughshod over it, and we're all victims of it. And that critique is the foundation of the critique against agriculture in America. And I think we could trace it most directly in this case back to the 1970s and the emergence of professional consumer advocacy, which at the time was very, very left-leaning and very much influenced by a Marxist argument.
So, you know, but before that, as far as regulating the industry and so forth, you also wrote about the alliance between President Theodore Roosevelt and muckraker Sinclair Lewis. I talked about it recently with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote about it as well recently. Regulatory reform type movement didn't come from that.
No, it did not. Well, Upton Sinclair was a devout in his own way. Mm-hmm. I'm not very kind to Upton Sinclair.
No, you're not.
Sorry. No, I'm not. he was a devout but fair weather socialist. And his critique was, in fact, socialist, which Teddy Roosevelt wanted nothing to do with. What Americans at the time were concerned with was, well, two things. Ordinary consumer Americans believed that big corporations were withholding food in order to drive up prices, and that's why food prices kept rising, because food prices 100 years ago in this country were exorbitant. It really didn't have anything to do with corporations withholding food. What it had to do with was that there just simply wasn't enough supply to meet the actual demand, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S. Upton Sinclair, the socialist, got mixed up in it because Teddy Roosevelt was concerned, rightfully so at the time, that in the new industrial economy, and the kind of economy we have now was quite new a century ago, he feared that unless Americans figured out some way to kind of tame pure capitalism, pure competition, let's say competition, not capital, if the United States government couldn't figure out how to tame pure competition, monopoly would, in fact, be the end result, and there would only be one maker of every single thing in the world. So Teddy Roosevelt came into office. Of course, he came in because of an assassination, but he was determined to exercise not just congressional authority, but also presidential authority. It's really a very interesting moment in politics. Mm-hmm. He really believed that the chief executive could be more powerful. And his whole thing was that the power of monopoly capitalism needed to be tempered because capitalism and industrial growth was good for the country, but if it just was allowed to continue untamed, it would simply drive itself into monopoly, and then what would happen next? Maybe communism or socialism. So you're right about that. There are really two things going on. One, the creation of a new industrial economy, but then this long, long period, about 25 years, of very, very, very high food prices because farmers and their technology simply could not keep pace with demand.
There was, we were just talking earlier about the new labeling laws for the meat industry and the meatpacking industry in particular. And the cost overall, the FDA is, the USDA, has estimated between $60 million and $192 million, which, you know, it's a lot of money to me, but it doesn't seem like that much money to the industry. You make the point in the book that the industry actually operates on a very narrow margin of profit and always has.
That's right. And I was at first a little skeptical myself on that point, but I am now a believer. It is just a fact. We'll just stick with a steer. On average, a single steer, let's take a 1,000-pound steer, which is actually quite a small one. Only about 550 or 600 pounds of that animal is actually edible. And Americans, because we're very finicky, won't eat most of the meat that comes with it. We don't eat shin. We don't want to eat organs. What we really want are steaks, tenderloin, ground beef, and so forth. Meat packers have struggled to try to figure out how to take that large animal, pay for the transportation, pay the person who raised the animal, and then slaughter that animal and, in effect, only sell the good stuff and still figure out how to make a profit. And until just after World War II, prior to that, what meat packers relied on were the so-called byproducts, which could be anything from the hide of the animal that was far and away the most valuable part, to using things like the bone, the thyroid, turning blood into fertilizer, using every single thing that they could and making byproducts of them, which in effect subsidized the low cost of the fresh beef. Because Americans became very, very upset, and still do, if the cost of fresh meat goes beyond some, you know, arbitrary, affordable price. So yes, they have always operated on this bare bones profit, and every time something like new labels come along, I don't know how they come up with those gigantic numbers. I was listening when the reporter from the Los Angeles Times was talking about it. I mean, I guess someone is calculating how many people do you have to hire to write the labels, print the labels, make the labels, ship the labels, I guess. But all of those things cut into what is a very, very tight profit margin.
I was going to ask you about the cuisine and how meats, the emphasis on meat in our country has affected our cuisine, but I think Robert from Westerville has a good way to ask about it. Hi, Robert. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Is that me?
Yes, it is, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Oh, okay, great. Just love your show, Ann.
Thank you.
This is totally interesting because I grew, this helps explain why my father, who grew up on a farm, and, you know, he fought in World War II, and he was always a farm boy that went to war, you know. And anyway, I could never understand why he would go through the annual hunting cycle, and sometimes twice a year he would find a way to go shoot a deer, you know. And he loved the organ meat, particularly, which really freaked me out. growing up in the McDonald's era, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that helps explain it. This has been totally interesting. Am I on the right track here?
Well, I was interested in how our meat cuisine has changed over time. Maureen Ogle?
Well, what it's changed from is back in the colonial period, the people who would become Americans pretty much ate everything. They would turn everything into some kind of food, and that included things like brains, the organs, and so forth. But Starting in the early 1800s, as Americans moved off the farm and into cities, they definitely lost their taste for shin, flank, snout, tongue, all those things that, generally speaking, we don't eat. And that is one of the factors, as now I'm coming back to the question right. You asked me before about how meat packers made a profit. By the end of the 1800s, when the first big packers like Swift and Armour had come into being, the reason they had such a hard time making a living was because they would sell a carcass or a half a carcass to a butcher, and the butcher would be left stuck with a whole bunch of that carcass that he simply could not sell to anyone, because even then Americans were demanding what we now regard as the sort of normal cuts, roast, loin, the sirloin, the tenderloin, those kinds of things.
So, I imagine the butcher's kids always got stuck with the tongue and stuff like that.
Well, they probably did. And obviously people who were at the lower end of the economic scale, or in many cases people who had just arrived from Europe, where those kinds of animal parts were still part of the diet, they would eat those. But what both Swift and Armour did, just as an example, was they learned very quickly that if they want to make a profit on this, they better figure out a way to just ship the parts to butchers that consumers would buy, and figure out how to turn the rest of it into things like canned gravy, canned beef stock, sausages, and the like. So, you know, they could turn those non-edible products into edible products at the slaughterhouse without shipping it. And that, I think, is interesting, because these days many people are like, oh man, I'm not going to eat a hot dog. Do you know what's in it? I'm not going to eat a sausage. Do you know what's in it? Well, what's in it is lots of perfectly good meat, organ parts that otherwise Americans won't eat.
Robert, thank you so much for that question. We have an email from Chuck in Clintonville, and it kind of goes back to earlier in the program when you said that you know you're not duped and that you control what you eat. Chuck writes, she may be in denial about the power of marketing. Plenty of research has shown a correlation between advertising and consumer behavior, and there is no controversy that the quote-unquote American diet has directly contributed to our obesity and diabetes problems because of processed meats and fast food. I think there is enough evidence to indicate that people are duped into making unhealthy food choices, and eating too much red meat is one of those choices. That's part of your conclusion, is there is a choice we have to think about making going forward.
That's right, and I appreciate that reader's question or comment. Mm-hmm. I guess it wasn't a question, it was a comment, because of course that's what I hear all the time. We could unpack that from now until tomorrow if you want to, and of course we can't. But as a matter of fact, the jury is still out as to what causes obesity, at the role of fat in our diets. That genuinely surprised me, and I devote a fair amount of that to the book, mm-hmm. making sure that everybody understands that the jury is, in fact, still out about that. The evidence is not that clear. But I agree that marketing can drive consumer behavior, as long as a consumer wants to let marketing. You know, if you hear a McDonald's commercial and decide to go to McDonald's, well, that's your choice. But you can also choose not to listen to that ad. So I'm just not willing to go down as a witless dupe. I'm not going to do it. That's all there is to it.
All right. You've said that what critics of the industrial food complex don't understand is that it's predicated on the fact that most Americans don't and never will make food. And our choices maybe would be much different if we actually made the food we eat.
That is a big part of the book, and we haven't touched on that at all, so I'm going to try to be quick about this. But here's one thing that became very, very clear to me early on in the 7 years that I spent researching and writing this book. The fact that we live in an urban society is the single most significant, powerful determinant of the kind of diet we have and the kind of agriculture we have. American consumers are urbanites. Overwhelming majority of us are urbanites. We do not grow our own foods. Yeah, maybe we have a backyard garden, but that's not enough. Urban gardens are never going to be enough to feed all of us. And so because we live in cities, we rely on a minuscule number of people to produce food for us. And we also insist that they do it at very low cost. And the whole balancing act between trying to make sure that farmers make a living, that food processors can earn a profit, and the consumers don't moan and complain about how low how high their food prices are. That is what drives food politics in this country in the form of agricultural subsidies. I mean, that's a whole other really, really complicated issue.
You're not, though, an apologist for the meat industry. You were a vegetarian for 25 years. Where is the argument to change our way of life anyway?
My personal opinion is that everybody should eat whatever they want. If people decide that they don't want this kind of meat system, here's the fastest way to change it. We're not going to do it through government regulation. We're not going to do it by banning CAFOs or antibiotics. Just stop eating so much meat. We eat a lot of meat. On average, Americans eat somewhere in the neighborhood of 225 pounds a year. Now, that's an average. I only eat 25 pounds a year, and a lot of people are vegetarians. That means somebody out there is eating way more than 225 pounds of meat a year. The only way to satisfy that demand that I can see is with the system we have. So if what you really want to change is the system, just start eating meat in the way that, I almost hate to bring this up, Asians do, where meat is never the center of the plate. It's a condiment. It's a part of something larger. That, you know, if you reduce demand, the whole system will change. But as long as we have this demand, the system is not going to go anywhere.
You are also a defender of the pink slime that grabbed all the headlines a few years ago. Now, is pink slime, is that stuff still legal? And why do you defend it? Because it grosses people out so much.
Well, the reason it grosses people out is because they've been given a completely, grossly inaccurate version of what it is. As much as I like Jamie Oliver, his presentation, and that's what started all of it, his presentation on his TV program was unbelievable. There wasn't a single accurate component of that whole two-minute clip from his TV show about pink slime. The pink slime makers never got a chance to explain what it is and why it is. Pink slime is simply all of the meat that's left on the bone after the carcass has been broken down into what are called primal cuts. Pink slime is nothing more than what frugal housewives or frugal cooks have been doing since human beings stood upright, extracting every single bit of edible stuff, putting it into a centrifugal mix master, and spinning the fat and the gristle off. Pink slime is just plain old meat. There's nothing wrong with eating it. I'm not so much defending it as I'm criticizing Americans who are so happy to jump on an uneducated, ill-informed bandwagon. It's infuriating. The guy who created pink slime, the Eldon Roth, the founder of BPI, is a self-made guy. I mean, if you want a guy who sort of pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and, you know, built a company, there's the guy, and this has pretty much destroyed his business. There's nothing wrong with pink slime. It's meat, pure and simple.
By 2050, we expect almost 10 billion people will inhabit the Earth. Experts from around the world, certainly around the country, gather pretty routinely now to talk about how in the world we're going to feed everybody in the world. What do you bode for the future of our diet going forward, really just a few decades from now?
Well, you asked the wrong person because I am both by nature and trade a historian, and I can just tell you these predictions about population and how, you know, blah, blah, blah. In fact, I address this issue in the book. Frankly, nobody knows how many people there are going to be or what the food's going to be. I've read 150 years worth of these predictions. None of them are ever accurate, so I have absolutely no idea. I'm sorry to tell you. It's kind of interesting. I think that right now a lot of really smart people are trying to figure out how to make meat, we'll put that in quote marks, in a laboratory that's not really meat. So, you know, that maybe that'll be one thing, but I am not even going to attempt to make a prediction about what's going to happen, because I wouldn't be any more right than anybody else would be.
Well, Maureen Ogle, thanks for sharing your historical perspective on our relationship with meat in the United States.
Thanks for having me, Anne. I really appreciate it.
Maureen Ogle, she is a historian and the author of a new book. It's called In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.